Hi, this is Patty Peltakos, the Monday host of A Public Affair. If you like what you hear on WORT, please consider sending us a donation of whatever amount. And remember to listen to the A Public Affair podcast. Thanks. Bye.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of the tribal war.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Monday, January 25th, 2021 edition of A Public Affair. My name is Patty Peltakos and I'll be your host this hour. On today's show, writer Ross Benesch will be talking with us about his new book, Rural Rebellion, How Nebraska Became a Republican Stronghold. Ross grew up in Brainerd, Nebraska, whose population in 2010 was 330. Ross is now living in New York City, which has a slightly different population density than where he grew up, and of course, slightly different politics. Ross's writing has appeared in sites including thenation.com and 538.com. Ross, welcome to A Public Affair.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on the program.
Oh, thanks so much for joining me today. So, Ross, why did you decide to write Rural Rebellion?
Yeah, you know, if people who know me would be surprised that I'm writing a politics book. I usually write, you know, things about pop culture. But after Donald Trump got elected and we, you know, were in this weird political moment, I noticed people in New York City, where I live now, being suddenly very curious about places like Nebraska, where I came from. And I thought there was a chance to give those areas some attention, and that if I was, you know, ever going to write about my hometown and get people to notice, this would be the time while, you know, people on the coast are innately curious about Middle America.
Okay. And I just wanted to find out, what do you see as the actual rebellion occurring or that has occurred in Nebraska?
So to give you an idea why I went with that title, when I was born, we had two Democratic senators in Nebraska, Democratic governor, Democratic House members. And now we only elect Republicans, and we elect those who are much further to the right than those who we elected 15 years ago. So I call it rural rebellion because Republicans are winning in our state and throughout the middle of the country by gaining like 70, 80, sometimes 90% of voters in rural areas. Our Republican governor and senators lose in our cities like Omaha and Lincoln, but they still will win by overwhelming margins because they carry the rural area so heavily. And that wasn't the case when I was younger. So what I've seen is rural areas react and move to the right, and they are voting with the party that they believe is going to push back against, you know, liberals in the cities. And I see it kind of as a reactionary thing. And that's why I went with the title Rural Rebellion, because they've voted in such a massive block for Republicans.
Now, in the book, you talk a little about gerrymandering, but I'm wondering, has gerrymandering had much of an impact in Nebraska? I mean, here in Wisconsin, we have incredibly gerrymandered districts, which has contributed to the Republican power grab here in our state. But I'm wondering, is that similar in Nebraska?
Democrats lose so many races so frequently in so many different types of jurisdictions that it'd be impossible to blame their problems just on gerrymandering. I will say in the Omaha area, I mean, when you're losing all three congressional districts and mayor's races and governor's races and you're not competitive, I mean, how can you blame redistricting, you know? But I will say that the second congressional district where Omaha is, which is our biggest city, that would be more favorable to Democrats if it wasn't gerrymandered. It was gerrymandered pretty solidly in 2010, and I'm sure it's going to be gerrymandered again now because, you know, the census is coming up, so we're going to be redoing redistricting again. But outside of that district, the other losses can't be explained by those forces.
Okay. Now, in the 2020 election, Nebraska sent four of its electoral votes to Trump, one to Biden. I didn't even realize that there were states that split up their votes. So I was wondering, could you talk a little about Nebraska being a state that does split its electoral vote, and if that's something that that Republicans are working to change?
Yep, I could talk about that. And, you know, that's just kind of one of many things Nebraska has done over the course of time that's been very innovative with their government. We have a very unique state legislature, for instance, which I can get into later. Now, as far as the electoral vote splitting,
yes,
that happened in the early 1990s. There was a state senator named Diana Shimmick, and she helped adopt this system. Only us and Maine have this system where each congressional district gets its own electoral vote that's independent from the statewide total. And the Republicans, basically every year since it's been introduced, I think they've tried to do it 17 times now, they have tried to repeal that because they don't want to, you know, have the embarrassment of losing a district to a Democrat. But what's been great about that is that it brings much more attention and money to Nebraska than it would have otherwise. So President Trump visited Omaha just a few weeks before the election because they knew that was a competitive district. They ended up losing it. And even though they're going to carry Nebraska handily, they wanted to, you know, place more emphasis on Omaha. If we didn't have that district splitting, it would just be taken for granted that Republicans win and no one would stop into town. Now, as far as Republicans trying to eliminate it, I mentioned they've tried to do it like 17 times. I recently wrote an article for The Nation about how they're just going to keep doing that. And on the second day of the legislative session this month, they introduced the bill aimed at eliminating that provision. And I don't think they'll get it through in the legislature, because I think most Nebraskans like it and they're going to talk to their state senator to make sure that they don't support this. But what's scary is our governor comes from a family worth billions, and he could drop a lot of money on a ballot initiative to get it taken away, because we just provided a vote for Joe Biden and Nebraska Republicans don't like that, and they can market it against that.
So how do party affiliations affect candidates and races at the local and state level in Nebraska? And do people go by party affiliations? And you can talk about the unicameral House and how that works as well.
Yeah, so the unicameral House, Nebraska is the only state that doesn't have party names attached to their state legislature. It's been that way since the 1930s. And we also only have one house. So we have the smallest legislature in the U.S., just 49 representatives total. Now, for a long time that worked and people weren't really voting on party names, but it's become much more partisan since the year 2000. And there's really three reasons why that is. The first one is term limits. A bunch of outside money came in and they passed term limits through a ballot initiative. And the main reason they did that is they wanted to push out a few longstanding liberal state senators. So with term limits and more turnover, the parties are way more active in recruiting and controlling who will run. And then the other thing is campaign finance deregulation that's occurred over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. That's just an onslaught of attack ads. These districts of 35,000 people in Nebraska used to be really cheap to campaign in. And now you're seeing people drop $500,000, even though to be a state senator in Nebraska, you only obtain $12,000 a year. So it's pretty asinine. And then the third thing is that our governor comes from a family worth billions, and he very much has tried to control the legislature and put his own people into office. So it has become more partisan and resembling other state legislatures. And there has been a push from the outside advertising to get people to vote on party lines. However, I will say we haven't gone as far in that direction as nearby states like Kansas have. You know, Nebraska has been successful in protecting its public schools, not passing voter ID laws, some of these other things that you've seen in Midwestern state legislatures. But the nonpartisan name, though, is becoming more window dressing over time. And, you know, it's very much becoming resembling other states, even though we have this unique feature.
Okay. If you are just joining us, you are listening to the Monday, January 25th, 2021 edition of A Public Affair. This is Patty Peltakos, and I'm your host this hour. On today's show, writer Ross Benish is talking with us about his new book, Rural Rebellion, How Nebraska Became a Republican Stronghold. We want to hear from you on today's show, so if you have a question or comment for Ross, please give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. Or you can email us at talk@wortfm.org, and we are on social media at facebook.com/WORTTalk and Twitter at WORTTalk. So, Ross, how much do you think social media had an impact on the 2020 election? And do people, especially in rural Nebraska, rely on social media for their news?
I think social media has had a huge impact on both urban and rural areas for the last several elections. That's part of the reason I feel like we've lost our collective minds, is we've gotten into these wormholes on Twitter and on Facebook. And people in Brainerd, my hometown, definitely rely on social media a lot for their news. Something that's made them more reliant is that so many rural areas have lost their newspapers, or their newspapers are a fraction of what they used to be. So in Nebraska, the vast majority of newspapers are owned by one chain, Lee Enterprise, and they've had a lot of budget cuts over the years, and papers don't print as often. And, you know, people would become more reliant, I think, on social media anyways, but that definitely makes them more reliant when you start to get into those areas where it's like a news desert, and you're just relying on what your friends shared to learn about your community. And that gets to be a little perilous.
Right. And is broadband or connectivity an issue for rural residents in Nebraska?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely an issue. It's improved a little bit, but I, you know, even just a few years ago, I would go to my sister's farmhouse, and, you know, they still had dial-up, basically, and, you know, to access anything, I'd have to find somewhere where I could use my mobile data reliably, and that was a huge pain for, you know, them to operate, like, in the 21st century. So rural broadband is definitely a pain point. And I think that's an issue that Democrats would have some room to run with, because Republicans who have been in power in my home state haven't done that great of a job in expanding rural broadband, because, you know, internet service providers are for-profit companies, and they often don't have the incentive to build out an infrastructure where there's going to be few customers. So they just don't. And those areas get left behind. So government support of internet infrastructure, I think, would be supported even by, you know, conservatives who tend to favor Republicans otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And do you think the funding would be there to put into broadband expansion in the state? Is that something Republicans would be willing to pay for?
Well, the way they like to slash budgets and cut taxes, they probably wouldn't be willing to pay for it. But the money would be there if they had the willpower. I mean, we fund all sorts of other projects, whether it's military or agriculture. So a U.S. senator from Nebraska could go get those funds earmarked if they really, really wanted to, I like to believe.
Okay. So, going back a little bit to your family, I'm wondering, is politics something your family talked about when you were growing up, and was paying attention to elections, especially, say, like state and local elections, something that you felt like you and the people in your town were paying attention to?
We did not pay nearly as much attention to politics as like people in cities like New York do. We spent much less time in my family talking about elections than we did in trying to figure out who would be the third string quarterback for the Huskers during spring football. So it wasn't super high on our priority list. My parents did campaign for one governor candidate and for one state senator candidate, but that was only because family members of theirs were friends of them. So they were kind of doing it as a favor for like Mike Johans and for Lauren Schmidt when he was in the state Senate. And you asked one other question. I'm trying to remember what it was.
I think I was asking about the importance of local and local elections to your family.
Well, one way we talked about politics, though, was it wasn't often directly. There was a lot of preaching at the pulpit, and we were very Catholic. Church was a huge part of the community. So even if we weren't always just talking about, you know, Democrat versus Republican for state Senate or for governor race, whatever the campaign happened to be, we did talk about politics when abortion was constantly referenced or when gay marriage was constantly referenced. So I would say the politics discussions were there. They just weren't quite as direct. We weren't like breaking out down policy papers by prospective candidates. It was more, we believe in these theoretical principles come hell or high water, and we can apply them, you know, to the elections as needed after that.
Well, what about things like, you know, school board? Because I'm assuming that in your town there were races for school board members and also for a mayor, or at least some form of town board. So was that something that you paid attention to, or did it really not matter a whole lot at that point?
My town is so small that the town board and mayor is just who we can convince to do the job because it's kind of thankless and doesn't pay much. So the town is just happy.
Well, yeah, there is that.
My dad served on the zoning board for like 25 years and he thinks it's a huge pain and that he just does it as like a civic duty. If someone wanted to run against him, I think he'd be very happy to be voted out of it. For school board, there was more attention definitely paid to that because the school is the lifeblood of a small town. I mean, when I saw neighboring towns lose their schools, you really saw those towns go downhill and start to lose families and jobs and other things. So people did pay attention to school board meetings for sure. But I don't recall, I mean, and maybe it's because I was young, I wasn't paying much attention. I don't recall the campaigns for that ever being too heated. A lot of times people would still run unopposed. Maybe if I lived in a slightly bigger area, there'd be more competition. But my hometown was so small that we were just fighting to keep our schools open. I mean, the school next to us closed down when I was in college and we consolidated. And we've still dropped the classification level. We were class C when I was in high school. Now we're class D. We're not close to closing, but that's like a bigger fear than the politics within the school. But I think at a slightly bigger school, you'd probably see a little different situation.
Mm-hmm. And as far as getting people to run, are there younger people in these communities and are they deciding to run for offices?
You know, I have seen people around my age, some people who are a little bit older who went to high school, my brother, running for things like town board and school board, which is refreshing. But there are fewer young people in my home area than there were when I grew up. And I'm sure there'll be fewer people 10 years from now. It's really difficult because there's a big brain drain. And not to sound narcissistic, but I'm part of the problem. You know, there's people like me who grew up in those towns. And then to get a quality public education, we went to the state university, which was in the big city in that state. And then our best job opportunity came in a different state. And then we left. And it's a huge problem for those towns. And it's another reason why Democrats are less competitive in those areas too, because young people with degrees is a reliable Democratic voting block. But there aren't many of those people in rural Nebraska right now.
And what about immigrants who are able to vote and I guess city urban voters, especially Omaha and Lincoln?
Well,
is that kind of the typical Democratic stronghold?
Yeah. So Omaha and Lincoln is the Democratic stronghold, but Republicans are winning just as many races as the Democrats in Omaha. I mean, Republicans have the House seat there; they have the mayor's office, for instance. Now with with immigrant voters, there's some towns near where I grew up where they've seen a lot of demographic change because they've had a beef packing plant expand and they slashed their union. And, you know, therefore they went and recruited foreign labor because the people who are born in the U.S. don't even want to work those jobs anymore. And there's a little bit of lag, though, because those people who are coming to work, it takes some time for them to become permanent residents or citizens. And then voting participation doesn't tend to increase until like after a generation. So Schuyler, Nebraska, it's a town that most people don't even speak English as their primary language. It's just like 6,000 people, has a big beef packing center outside of town. Just in the last few years, they elected their first Latina council member. And the town has been, you know, moving in the direction where it's becoming much more diverse for over 20 years, but it took a generation. And so you're starting to see that now in some of these towns, but the immigrant voters are underrepresented for a while. And many of them don't permanently live in those areas. They may not work for that plant for that long. So they move somewhere else. It's hard to establish ties until the next generation. And I think that makes it tough for Democrats out there. The county that Schuyler is in, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but white residents would be in the minority. But if you look at voting turnout, it's, you know, completely flipped, which is unfortunate. Democrats are winning in Lincoln and Omaha, but if you have enough people in rural areas, you really have to drive the margins up in the cities to be competitive statewide. And they haven't been able to do that. It's tough. We're 42nd in population density. So unless if you're going to win Lincoln by like 80 to 20 margins, you're fighting an uphill battle when it comes to statewide.
Mm-hmm. And as far as industry in Nebraska, I mean, I'm assuming that in Nebraska, as in so many other states, especially say like Iowa and even here in Wisconsin, small family farms have been kind of eaten up by larger, more industrial scale farms. Is that accurate? And
that's accurate.
Is that the way farming is moving in Nebraska?
I think that's just the way farming's moving everywhere. Unfortunately, you know, when, you know, the 1980s farm crisis happened, that was back at a time when you would have four families on a section of land. And now, one family can do many sections of land. You know, the machines are so much more powerful and efficient. So fewer people are needed to operate. And that's tough because for many people, this is a way of life. It's not just a job. It's been passed down through generations. They've come to expect that hard work will provide them a decent life. And the corporatization of farming has made that very difficult for many people, unless if you're in like the top 10% of largest farmers, other people mostly have difficulties.
And is Nebraska seeing any kind of resurgence of smaller and maybe sustainable and organic farms? And are younger farmers able to get a start in farms like that in Nebraska?
So as far as like organic farming, I don't have any data on that. I have seen some anecdotal evidence of that. I mean, one of my good friends who was from my hometown in Brainerd, his family pivoted and they have like an organic farm with, you know, fresh vegetables that people from Lincoln will even drive into town to, get a month's supply of. But I haven't seen that stuff scale the way, the larger, more industrial farming has. You know, most of Nebraska's land is still just large, you know, wheat, soybean, and cornfields. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as younger farmers
and cattle, right?
Oh yeah, and cattle. Yeah, absolutely. Lots of ranching. I was just talking about crops. The two go hand in hand.
Right.
Now, younger farmers getting a start. That's really tough. My nephews are in their 20s and they're trying to buy their own land and start, and the upfront costs are significant. And unless if you have it mm-hmm. handed to you from family or some other means, I mean, that's really hard to make a life out of that. There's some people trying, but they're fewer you know, every decade there's fewer of them. I think the organic stuff is going to be a little more niche in Nebraska, still growing, but I just don't see it rivaling the size of what I would, people call commercial farming. I just call it regular farming.
Mm-hmm. And so given that that is happening, has that kind of hollowing out of rural communities because the farms are so much bigger. I mean, has that been a big factor in the loss of population in rural Nebraska and really kind of the, I guess, the collapse of small towns?
That's definitely been a factor. The industrialization of farming has withered those towns. And now if a small town isn't near Interstate 80, its prospects aren't that great right now. I mean, they're probably going to show declining population in the census. I bet when these figures come out, I bet 85 of our 93 counties show declining population. It's a huge problem. And, you know, I'd like to think that technology and now that everyone is working remotely during the pandemic, it shouldn't matter as much where you live to do most jobs, that could help bring a resurgence to rural areas. But so far, every time there's been a big technological advancement, it's resulted in more industrialization and urbanization. So I see those towns only continuing to lose population right now, which is a bit sad because I really enjoyed growing up the way I did in Brainerd.
Well, I was wondering, I mean, you are in New York now, but given COVID, would you consider returning to Nebraska and working, you know, remotely and electronically from Nebraska?
I would consider it if I was a single man, but I am engaged to be married, and my soon-to-be wife is from this area and has always lived in this area. And so I have stronger roots here now, and my job's here. I think my job might give me some flexibility now with COVID, but I'll probably be here for the long haul right now. But if you would have asked me a few years ago, before I established a relationship, I would have been more open to that, especially to save money on rent.
Ah, okay. If you are just joining us, you are listening to the Monday, January 25th, 2021 edition of A Public Affair. My name is Patty Peltakos, and I'm your host this hour. On today's show, writer Ross Benesch is talking with us about his new book, Rural Rebellion, How Nebraska Became a Republican Stronghold. So if you have a question or comment for Ross, please give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. And I would like to encourage listeners who have not called to give us a call and ask a question. Or if you'd like, you can email us at talk@wortfm.org or reach us on social media at facebook.com/WORTTalk or Twitter at WORTTalk. So Ross, I guess moving back to your book, you devote a whole chapter to abortion rights, and you've talked a little bit about that. But I was wondering if you could go into more detail about what you see as the role of abortion rights in shaping the vote in Nebraska.
Sure. And abortion was the first chapter at that, because it had such a monumental impact. You know, in those small towns especially, where the church isn't just something you do on Sundays, it's a big part of the community. I mean, it's where, like, you send your kids for certain programs, and you go to weddings, and you have parties there, and it provides so much fulfillment. But during the culture war battles of the 80s and 90s, the church became much more active with abortion rights and on you know, coming after abortion providers. And that's had a big impact, because before all that happened, each party didn't have a clearly staked position on abortion. If you go back to, like, the time of Roe v. Wade, it was Republican governors like Ronald Reagan and Nelson Rockefeller, who helped sign abortion laws into their own states before it went nationwide. And there were pro-choice Democrats, many of Nebraska's Democrats at the time. But now it's become this big political issue, and the parties have clearly defined their stake. Democrats are pro-choice, Republicans are pro-life. It shouldn't be as simple as that dichotomy, but in many voters' minds it is. And after that happened, that's when I saw a lot of church-going people who were formerly part of like the FDR Democrat coalition leave that. And, you know, they cared more about those cultural wedge issues than they, you know, maybe did about labor unions. And that swayed them to the Republican Party. It had a massive effect. I'm sure in other states, this contributed to Republican losses for their zealotry on being pro-life. But in Nebraska in particular, I believe Democrats really rode to glory on that issue. I mean, Republicans really rode to glory on that issue.
Democrats
were affected negatively.
We do have a caller on the line with a question, but I kind of want to get back to abortion in just a second, but we'll take Terry's call first. Okay. Hi, Terry, please go ahead with your question or comment.
Hi, I think part of my question was just answered by the discussion about the church's role. Basically, I'm wondering, why does it seem like people in rural areas and small towns seem to think so differently than people in the cities? For example, you were just saying how the large corporation farms have made, you know, life so differently, and yet the Republicans and the people who believe in Republicans are still so pro business and big businesses, you know, messing with their lives. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
I think that's a very good question.
Thank you, Terry.
So what I would say is that in those rural areas, it's not always as clear how the marketplace may be negatively affecting you and how in some ways the government may be benefiting you. The sentiment has become, it's the government's fault for what has happened, for our declining population, for our way of life becoming closer to extinction. So, some of those issues you just blamed, people who I grew up with would probably blame government for those issues. And when the government tries to implement some sort of rule that helps protect people from the excesses of big business and capitalism, there is usually pushback against that. And there isn't as, you know, the people there tend to believe that they can self-govern because that's their perception out there, even though governments spend more funds per capita in rural areas than they do in urban areas. That isn't as much of a perception. So in rural areas, as people become more aligning with Republicans, I think they've given a more of a pass to big businesses and markets, and just become more likely to blame the government for some of those problems that you mentioned.
So to get back to the topic of abortion rights, I mean, what do you think it would take to get beyond abortion rights as an issue, as such a defining issue of the two parties for rural voters?
It's very difficult because as long as Republicans are continuing to make that their number one issue, I don't know if Democrats can ever completely move away from it. And Republicans have very strong incentive to make that their number one issue. It's worked very well for them. I'm not sure what the solution is because there's been some races in Nebraska where the local candidate has done a good job of not making it about abortion. But then someone, whether it's a national party Democrat person or someone from the opposition, the Republican side, inevitably tries to drag that into the race. I mean, we could be talking about something as small as a city council race and it will come in. So I wish I had a great answer for you, but I don't have any solutions right now. I think it's going to be with us until Republicans are forced to talk about something else a little more.
And I'm also wondering if the issue of individual liberty is so important to rural Republican voters in Nebraska, why they don't see the issue of abortion as an issue of individual liberty and something to be decided by the woman.
Yeah, I think it
not,
comes down,
not by the church.
Yeah,
no, you know, go ahead. No, go ahead.
I think it comes down to it's a little bit more of a theoretical precept. It's kind of like in those areas, resistance to immigration is greater. And, you know, if you're in Brainerd, Nebraska, you probably don't know any immigrants. I certainly did not when I lived in that town. So it was easier to vote on like a good versus evil on this one stance when it was theoretical and you weren't seeing as much how it may affect people. So, you know, I think in cities, you see what a lack of a social safety net can do, and you see homelessness, and you know, and if to look at the issue of immigration, people's rights are taken away, you see that, and people there tend to be more supportive of immigrant issues or more supportive of abortion rights. So I just believe in a rural area, when unless if you know someone who's personally had an abortion, it's much easier to put it in good versus bad terms and then, you know, vote on that.
Okay. Well, we do have another caller on the line. Hi, Thomas. Please go ahead with your question.
Yeah, my question was at the revolt in Washington, D.C., were there any members that you know of that were from rural Nebraska because of the conspiracy theories that Trump and other people had kept going? And the second part of that is, if the rural communities are reduced in federal funding, would that change the makeup, or would they still say, well, we're going to vote Republican? And how has that affected them when the Democrats in Congress have given out monies for farm aid and so forth? And I'll hang up and take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas.
That was a thoughtful question. So on that first part, I don't personally know anyone who was at the insurrection. If I do, they have been shamed into not publicly stating they were a part of that horrific event. I've definitely seen conspiracy theories on Facebook. And one thing I noticed, though, is that they seem to proliferate more right after the Iraq election, more claims of voter fraud at that point. And since the insurrection, people who were saying that, I haven't seen them quite as vocal. This is very anecdotal, but maybe that has shamed them a little bit into accepting reality. I don't know, but anecdotally, I don't know anyone who was at that. But I have read stories about Nebraskans going there, but I don't know any of them. Now, on the other part about federal funding, that's a good point that you made. Democrats in Nebraska and throughout the Great Plains, like in South Dakota, Iowa, in the late 80s, and actually won a lot of voters by having federal support for agriculture. After the farm crisis during that era, and a lot of people got fed up with Republicans' lack of support of farming, and Democrats took that as an opportunity to, you know, have more federal assistance, and that helped them win some seats. But that was a long time ago. Right now, people are so strongly identifying with Republicans that I believe most where I'm from would still vote Republican, even if Democrats significantly increased funding to those areas. You know, so some of it is, it's like an identity thing. It's not just a by the issues thing. And to give you an example, our state passed the minimum wage overwhelmingly, but through ballot measure. But they also elected a bunch of Republicans who opposed that exact same measure. So when it's put through a party lens, I still think people in those areas will vote for Republican. But those are good ideas you have of how, you know, Democrats may be able to be slightly more competitive.
And you, early on in the show, you mentioned the military, and I'm wondering, are military bases a big part of, I guess, what would be kind of the economic backbone of Nebraska, aside from farming and agribusiness, that type of business in the state?
Yeah, Offutt Air Force Base outside of Omaha is a huge economic engine for that region. And there's a lot of people who live in Nebraska because they are employed by the military. And, you know, despite a lack of support from most public institutions right now, the military is still very much supported in Nebraska. And our politicians have been, you know, they were lobbying pretty heavily to try to get the federal government to move the Space Force Command to Omaha. You know, Trump chose a different location, but yeah, the military is definitely a big industry out in that part of the country.
And what about the railroad? I mean, I've taken the train from the Twin Cities to Seattle, and I'm fairly certain we did not go through Nebraska on either of the northern or southern routes when they both existed. But I'm wondering, as far as, you know, rail service and especially commercial rail, is that a huge factor in people staying in a town because they still have access to a train for you know, shipping goods?
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, we still do have Amtrak running through, and Nebraska is the home of Union Pacific, and Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's company, you know, has investments in, mm-hmm. in a lot of railroads. So Nebraska does have a strong history that's tied to the railroads, especially the Union Pacific Railroad. But I don't see that as being a huge reason why people leave or stay. The passenger rails, you know, have been pretty inactive in Nebraska for a while. And I think it's just if you live out
pretty
there, you
everywhere.
Have to have a car. Yep, exactly. So, and I don't know if there's the population density to do a rail service out there. I mean, maybe you could do something just between Omaha and Lincoln. There is a lot of commuting that occurs between those two cities, and they're not that far apart. But that's about the only connection that comes to mind where you would be able to, you know, have reliable rail service. Otherwise, it would have to be heavily funded and operate at a loss to, you know, exist out in the more, you know, rural areas.
So I take it that is not something that comes up in state level elections.
No. It's not. It doesn't come up the same way that it does in like Philadelphia or Baltimore or even like Milwaukee. You know, is going to be way more likely to have use for something like that than Omaha would. Mm.
Okay. Again, if you are just joining us, you are listening to the Monday, January 25th, 2021 edition of A Public Affair. This is Patty Peltakos, and I'm your host today. On today's show, writer Ross Benesch is talking with us about his new book, Rural Rebellion, How Nebraska Became a Republican Stronghold. And we'd love to hear from you. If you have a question or comment for Ross, please give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. Or you can email us at talk@wortfm.org or reach us on social media at facebook.com/WORTTalk or Twitter at WORTTalk. And it looks like we have an email question. This is from Ron. And he's asking a question that, thank you, Ron. I have been wondering about this too. Basically, how quickly the Ogallala Aquifer is being depleted and what that will do to the farming communities that depend on it?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer on how fastly, how quickly it is being depleted. I wish I had that data right ahead of me.
I think it's pretty quickly.
One thing I could say about the Ogallala Aquifer being under threat, aside from water levels and droughts, is there was going to be a pipeline that was going to be going through there, but
activists
fought that.
Excel.
Yep. Activists in Nebraska fought that, and it made its way through the courts and the legislature, and it was fought in other states because there's a big pipeline going, you know, basically across the middle of the country. But Biden just made a pretty big announcement that he was going to halt it.
Yeah.
You know, Trump had reversed Obama's position, now Biden. So that's going to have a big impact on the Ogallala Aquifer, is, you know, stopping the production of that pipeline. But the water levels, I don't have a specific answer for you.
And as far as having an impact in the state, I mean, might that also impact what Democrats are able to do in Nebraska, given that Biden has now canceled or rescinded the permit for Keystone XL?
I think that is a good issue for Democrats to campaign on in Nebraska. You know, there were some jobs that are lost by not building the pipeline, but most of those jobs are temporary. So, I think the environmental impact would be much larger than what the economic impact would have been. And Democrats, I'm sure, have polling on this, but my impression is that this is a well-received action throughout most of the state to protect the aquifer, because it's been instrumental in the settling of our state. So we should be doing everything to protect it.
And our water rights and kind of water permitting, does that break down into yet another kind of rural-urban divide issue, or Republican versus Democrat for the most part?
I wish I had a good answer for you on water rights. I'll plead my ignorance on this one.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that then. So Ross, in your book, you do write about energy in Nebraska, and Nebraska having basically public energy utilities. Could you talk about that a little bit? I mean, how did that happen? And do people see that in Republican Democrat terms, or is that kind of beyond that?
So the energy thing, it's sort of another thing that goes back to Nebraska Senator George Norris, who served during the time of FDR. He was the one who helped establish our unique unicameral legislature. And he also helped move the state to municipal-owned utilities. So we're the only state in the United States where all utilities are publicly owned. It's helped keep costs down. Our costs tend to be a little bit lower than our neighboring states. And people in Nebraska don't tend to think of that as Democrat versus Republican. The history books are pretty interesting because conservatives at the time were saying that it was socialism run amok. And that's how they're trying to campaign against it, because, you know, they wanted businesses to operate these things. But in Nebraska, it's just been tradition. And my feeling is that people there don't even think of it as progressive. And if they haven't lived in another state, they may not even realize how unusual that is. It's not until you get a bill from like Con Edison that you really realize how unique it is to have, you know, all public power in Nebraska. And I would cite that as one of several examples where there is progressivism in our state. But I think reason why this thing has been able to be so successful is that it isn't tied to a particular party, because whenever it gets tied to a certain party, such as the Democratic Party, it's almost as if that turns public opinion against it on its own.
Okay. And I'm also curious, I mean, you also spend a good deal of time writing about healthcare and what your take is on the impact of COVID. And if the impact of COVID in rural communities might be changing ever so slightly people's views on, say, having a single-payer healthcare system.
Yeah, you know, most people in rural Nebraska still don't favor government support of healthcare. We expanded Medicaid in 2018, but like 80% of our counties did not vote in favor. So that vote was mostly carried in Omaha and Lincoln. However, support for like government-sponsored healthcare has improved since Obama was in office, and it continues to improve. And I think COVID will be another thing where even if most rural Nebraskans don't approve of it, it is going in that direction a little bit. And the one thing that's really gotten more approval is protections for pre-existing conditions. And you mentioned COVID. I mean, half of the U.S. has to have a pre-existing condition by the time we're out of this pandemic. Mm-hmm. So, you know, having those protections in place is crucial. Another point I want to make about healthcare is that it was Nebraska's own last Democratic Senator, Ben Nelson, who gave that final vote for Obamacare. And then he got kind of pushed out of office after it. But that's proved to be a very mm-hmm. crucial vote during this pandemic. If we didn't have Obamacare, there'd be more people with, you know, pre-existing conditions who would be suffering even greater than they are financially right now.
Well, and I'm sort of wondering, because farmers, as you know, self-employed business owners, have to supply their own health care, and health care costs are a huge, I mean, they cost a lot. It's takes a lot of money to self-insure. Yeah, they're not going down. They just keep going up. So I was curious about that, but interesting. Okay. Well, Ross, we are getting close to the end of the hour, and I wanted to give you some time to wrap up a little bit. And one other thing I was really kind of curious about was just how you see party affiliations kind of impacting the state in the next few years. If you see people kind of moving beyond that at all, or if you see it just entrenching even more than it already is.
I unfortunately don't see people moving beyond that in rural Nebraska, at least. I know Biden won in Omaha, but the Republican Party still won that House seat. So I expect Nebraska Republicans to still dominate for the foreseeable future. Democrats' best chance to reverse that is in 2 years in the Omaha congressional district.
And do you see changes from groups like Bold Nebraska to really initiate some sort of electoral difference in those red areas? Or do you think it's going to have to come out of Omaha and Lincoln first?
I know those groups are trying to evangelize Democrats in rural areas, but they just have a lot of things working against them. So if Democrats are going to win in Nebraska, it'll be in the cities first. The best thing they could do is if they could just make the margin slightly better in rural areas. There are a long ways from winning, but if they could lose 60 to 40 instead of 80 to 20, that would have a significant effect on the rest of the state.
And I guess as in just about every state, do you think that a big push for that has to start at the local level in those races like the school board and, you know, the seats like your dad has, where they would actually become somewhat more competitive?
It would probably have to start at the local level. However, those local positions are best operated. Those local officials are more efficient the less partisan they are. So I think the best mayors in rural Nebraska are the ones who people don't even know what their political affiliation is. If you come out a little too proud as a Democrat in that area, you might not win re-election the next time.
Okay. Well, Ross, we are going to have to leave it there because we are running out of time. I've been speaking with Ross Benish. Thank you so much for joining me today, Ross.
Thanks so much for having me on the program.
Oh, you're welcome. Ross is the author of Rural Rebellion, How Nebraska Became a Republican Stronghold, published by the University of Kansas Press. Thanks so much to Rochelle and Sholly for all their help with today's show, and thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in tomorrow for A Public Affair with host Carousel Baird. And up next on Madison Bookbeat, Stu Levitan will be talking with Mary Lang Solinger about From Inspiration to Activism, a personal journey through Obama's presidential campaign. You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Six.
but six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, no precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Ha ha.
Michael, my dear.